rather. Well, actually, my dearest school friend got married and went to live in India. It's not showing. Is it on? Oh. Mm-hmm. Went to live in India. And after she'd been married about a year, she said, you must come out and stay with her, because by then she'd had a son, and he was my godson. So I went out to stay with her, just outside Calcutta. And then I had a cousin whose husband was in the Indian Army in Burma, and she said, oh, well, you can't come all that way and not come stay with us in Burma. So then I went to stay with them in Burma. And I was there, probably about 9 months, I suppose. And I learned as soon as I got there almost, that unmarried girls who go out east are known as the fishing fleet. So anyhow, that's where I met my husband. So I suppose that he was my fish. And I went home and I was after... About 9 months out there, and we were married in Scotland, and then I went out, which was in 1931.
And was he in the British Army out there?
No, he was in the Indian Army, but the Indian Army, which people don't seem to know, all the officers were either British or Australian. Well, there were two very great friends of ours who were Australian. They were all white, but you did have... You had, incidentally, by the way, the troops in the Burma army were not Burmese, who are the ones now. They were not trusted. And they had all the hill tribes, who were very like Gurkhas, the Kachins, the Chins, and the Karens. And they had company of each, and then the headquarters company. And they were like the Gurkhas, the hill tribes, and... Oh, so reliable, and they would have followed anybody, you know. And the officers had such faith in them, and they had so much trust in their officers. But not the Burmese, and they're the ones that you see in the army now, which are causing all these, it's military rule in Burma.
So the Indian Army controlled Burma at that time, didn't it?
It did. But, and it was the 3rd 20th, it was the number that my husband was in, was 3rd 20th Burma Rifles. And they were Indian Army until 1936, I think, when they got their independence. But they were still the same people that were serving there. And there were always British troops there as well. But we had the Gloucesters, and we had the KRRs, the King's Royal Rifles, when I was there. And they used to do 3 years, usually a 3-year stint, you know. Always one British regiment.
Do you think that's why your evacuation was so difficult? That if you'd been in the British Army, you would have got more attention when it came to the evacuation?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. No, I wouldn't say that at all, actually. No. Actually, to put it right down, to belong to the British, to become an officer in the British Army, you have to have private means, because they're not very well paid. But the Indian Army, where you're away from home, and you're overseas, and probably much harder living than it would be in Britain, say, you got better pay. But it was, even then, it's staggering, you know, look back on what it was. Yeah. But it would go further, I think, like that. And so really, the two that I knew well, these Australians, we stayed with both of them after we came out here, because my husband also had a brother who was in the First World War, and he had met an Australian nurse in the war, who nursed him when he had something wrong, I forget what, in India. And they got married, and he came out to live here. So he said to us, we really didn't find it easy to settle in England. We'd lost everything we possessed. We had nothing with which to make a home with. And you did realize that possessions didn't really matter. It was lives that mattered, and we all got out alive. But there are things that are very precious amongst your possessions. And when you haven't got anything, we found it very difficult to settle. And we were settled eventually in Bedford, because we could, there were two, a boys and a girls school there, which were highly thought of, but they were only day schools, they weren't boarding schools, but they were public schools, which you call private schools over here, public schools, they were really good. And we didn't like that, we didn't like the climate there. And particularly when, I think it might have been about 1947 came along, and everything froze. The river froze in Bedford. The milk froze. Everything froze. And we couldn't stand there. And this brother's law of mine said, well, you won't get that out here, you know. And we just, and he said, there are many more opportunities for the family. And so we upped and came. But we first settled in Aspendale. My husband came out ahead, and then I came with all the children 3 months later, because he had to find somewhere for us to live. I mean, you can't 7 people afford to stay in a boarding house or anything, if there was such a thing. I don't know in those days. That was 1949 when we came out. So he found a house in Aspendale, and so we moved in there. But we were very miserable, and we didn't find it. But the children at school found them very anti-British at that time. You know, they really felt the British had let them down. And they sort of took it out on the children, I think. And they, you know, they used to come back and say, well, that was horrid to me today. And of course, teased them about the bobby accents and things, I suppose, and that sort of thing. Anyhow, after 18 months there, and as I said, when I was telling somebody the other day, if anybody had offered us a free trip back to the UK in those 18 months, we'd have gone like a shot. But we didn't. We decided then to look for schools, and we decided on coming to Berwick, put them down for St. Margaret's, and then we looked for somewhere to live. And found a house over here. And we were there until all the education was finished. And then...
Where were you living in Berwick?
In Beale Street, in Corinna. Well, there were 2 acres then, sort of divided up. About 6 houses there now, I think. And we had a mini farm. We decided we had got to be self-supporting to be able to educate the children. So when we got there, the grass was like this, and the house, no hot water on, you know, little hut in the garden, which we'd never done. But, you know, we anyhow, we got sanitation put in, and we had got a hot water system. Oh, it was a chip thing. So we learnt an awful lot. And then we decided we needed a cow. And I knew one end from the other, that was all. But a friend that we'd made, he helped us buy one in the Dandenong market. And I learnt to milk. And then I made the butter, and we grew all our own vegetables. And we grew the vegetables in an old orchard. And there was an awful lot of fruit trees. We had got chooks and geese and ducks, and we used to take the geese and the ducks to the market. We learned so much. Many farmers. And then there was no road up Edward Street. It was just grass. So the cow used to be tethered out there every night with a biscuit of hay, you know. And anyhow, we grew all our own vegetables, everything except potatoes. We didn't have enough of that. We had cream and butter. And I made all the jam and bottled the fruit and whatnot. And I'd never worked so hard in my life. But it Well, anyhow, the children all grew up and left home, and we sold the place. We subdivided it, actually. Sold the house and then all the things. And then we went overseas for 18 months back to Britain. But that really settled us out here, because we found Britain so changed. And I had no hope. My home had gone, my mother had died, and it had been sold. And my sister, who lived there, and a brother too. And then he, my eldest brother, who had been paralyzed from childhood, had had polio, he married an Australian who nursed my mother, and they came out here. So that was great. So I had some family over here as well as all my own. But the eldest daughter never settled down over here, and she went back to England. And in 1963, she worked with the Fisheries and Wildlife Department, and she worked, where else did she work? Oh yes, she took a course at Burnley. She did horticulture, and she did quite a lot of that as well. And then she went home, and she stayed home in 1963, after having worked her way all around Australia. And she's back now. She's just retired. And she's back now, and I'm hoping she may settle over here again.
So when you were in Kashmir, when you were in Kashmir,
yes,
for the 20 months,
yes,
what was that like in those days? I mean, it was safe from the war.
Oh yes, it was. Oh, absolutely, because it's right at the extreme west of India,
right.
And it's now. Pakistan and India are fighting about it, you see. But it wasn't sort of divided in those days, you see.
Yes.
Pakistan, yes. And India, it was all India.
Yes.
Now it's focused Pakistan and Bangladesh and all the rest of it. No, it was absolutely beautiful, really beautiful. We had two summers in a place called Gulmarg, which was under snow in the winter, so then you had to go down to Srinagar.
Mm-hmm.
We had rented a house over there for the winter. And snow everywhere, it was absolutely, really lovely. And up in the Gulmarg in the summer we had Hut 58A. And we made very great friends with the people who took the neighbouring one. They were all empty in the winter, yes, they were all empty. But there was a hotel that kept open for people who were able to go up and think. And you rode up. There were no roads or anything. You had to ride on a horse or get carried in what they called a dooli. And you just went picnics with it. But this friend of mine taught the children, you see, so she was still with us. And she was with us for 11 years, so we just loved that. But of course there was always the anxiety, you know, about my husband not knowing where he was, and
yeah.
Getting mail was very sort of intermittent and so on. But at least he had peace of mind, because he knew we were all safe with her.
Did he see much sort of active service?
Oh yes, he did. Yes, he did. You mean altogether or just during the war?
During the war.
Well, you see, he was in the First World War in Mesopotamia, and then Kurdistan, and then he came back to Burma, and then he was in the Mopla Rebellion in India, seeing active service, and then there was, just before we got married, there was the Burma Rebellion, that was in 1930-31, he was in that. And then he was on a boundary commission between China and Burma. And then also he'd been in Malaya, it's all service there. And then of course Burma in the last war. And he was 32 years in the army, and he only retired in 1947, I think it was, he got back.
Mm.
So he went back, you know, after his leave, he had leave. Just actually, he was on leave because the area he had been soldiering in had been cleared of all Japanese, and they'd gone further south. So he was able to get a month's leave and get back to England And he was in with us in England when the VE Day happened. And I didn't remember what we did at all on VE Day. No, VJ Day, sorry, the wrong. VE Day, he wasn't there. I don't think we did anything on VE Day because it really didn't mean anything to me much. But VJ Day, I couldn't remember what we did, but the eldest daughter said, oh yes, you took, Peter and I, those are the two eldest ones, you took us off to have lunch somewhere. So that was the way we celebrated VJ Day. But then he had to go back again. He only had about a month's leave then. And so he had to go back to Burma and then to start up the country getting going again. And he did that for about 2 years before he retired.
So what was he doing at that stage in the reconstruction?
Well, he really, it was more of a civil job. He wasn't commanding troops then. He was really getting everything started and going again. I think he had probably a few troops, but not with the people he'd been up with in the north with. And actually, we had there was an ambush they set up, and they got a whole column of Japanese troops. The sort of thing they did—it sounds horrible, really—but they were called punjis, and they were sharpened bamboos, and they would riddle the jungle on either side of a road or something or another, and. Then they would have something on a tree, which somebody would drop, and then they would, you know, a bomb or something. Well, this actually happened. He was there, and they knew that a column of Japanese was coming up, and it was led by an officer who was mounted, and then he had his flag with a standard bearer behind, also mounted, and all the rest of it. Anyhow, they all just scattered like this in the jungle, and you see, they were all speared with these poisons. So they all went west. And no casualties to them. But this is what they did, you know, for animals, for tigers and things like that. So they knew all about, you know, how to do things. Anyhow, he got a flag. And we had it framed and we had it on the wall in England, but out here we didn't do anything much about it, and none of the family were interested in it. But my son in Sydney had some Japanese friends. He was an importer-exporter. Now this would have been 18 years ago, maybe, about that. And he thought he would like, this was a personal flag, and we took it over and showed it to these Japanese people, and they were writing, there was a red blob in the middle, you know, the usual thing, and writing all round the red blob, and also some writing in the top left-hand corner. And so we asked him what they was, and they said, oh, this is a flag that he's given before he goes to war. And they have a sort of gathering, and these are all his friends and relations that sign their names around the things, you see, as a sort of send-off. And we said, what are these small ones up here, small right? Oh, those are the women, you know. Well, anyhow. So, my husband had an idea that he would like to get it back to the widow, because it would mean so much to her. So these people took a photograph of the flag when we were holding it, and sent it to Japan and asked if anybody, if the widow or family of this man, because they obviously would know who it was. We thought it might have been the name of the village or something up in the corner, but it wasn't. Anyhow, back came the thing. Yes, thrilled to bits of family and children and then grandchildren, and they got photographs and all the rest of them and with the flag when they got it. And as a thank you, they sent us this, which is a samurai.
Oh.
Isn't he beautiful?
He unfortunately got the broken. But and those actually the book of all the photographs of the family and everything I've given to my son, because it's really a family sort of heirloom thing, really, isn't it? But that's terrific, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's a nice story, really, to get it back, isn't it?
Yes. Go back to the people.
To the people who that means so much to. But they wanted to know how he had died. So my husband said to me, what am I going to say? So we discussed, he said, I think I'll just say he died a soldier's death. So that's all he said.
Yeah.
He wasn't prepared to say how he died. But I suppose that's the end of my war story, really.
Right.